You're listening to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at sevillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at sevillepodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up on our homepage. I'm Dan Gould. The Congressional Candidates Showcase Forum is a biannual event sponsored by the Senior Statesman of Virginia. This year, two candidates for the U.S. House of Representatives, Democratic incumbent Tom Perriello and Independent challenger Jeffrey Clark, spoke at the event. Republican challenger Robert Hurt declined the SSV's invitation to attend. The event took place at the August 11, 2010 meeting of the Senior Statesman of Virginia. The meeting was held at the Charlottesville Senior Center. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. The program was moderated by best-selling author, historian, political analyst, and host of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now, Coy Barefoot.
Thank you. Thank you very much. This is a real thrill. We already have a bunch of questions ready to go. My name is Coy Barefoot. It's a privilege to welcome you to the 2010 5th District Congressional Showcase, an issues forum sponsored by the Senior Statesman of Virginia. Founded in 1996, the Senior Statesman of Virginia is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization created to educate seniors, identify and articulate their viewpoints on the issues affecting all the citizens of Virginia. This is an all-volunteer organization. There is no staff. They are citizens of this great state, members of our community, and they're committed leaders and proud to work to make democracy stronger. You can learn more online at seniorstatesman.org. The event today is not a debate. This is an issues forum. There's no resolution that will be challenged, positive or negative. This is an opportunity that we have as citizens to hear from our candidates for office, the 5th district seat in the United States House of Congress. Incumbent Congressman Tom Perriello is with us today. He is a member of the Democratic Party and was first elected to Congress in 2008. Independent candidate Jeff Clark is with us as well. Jeff is a member of the Danville Tea Party, but said that he supports the Republican Party as well. Virginia Senator Robert Hurt, the Republican nominee, was invited to participate, as you just heard. He has declined, and I'm sure I speak for everyone in this room when I say that I wish he had chosen to join us. The Charlottesville Daily Progress reported this morning that Robert Hurt is the first candidate to decline to participate in this forum since the Senior Statesman launched the event in 1996. So here's how it's going to work today. We'll begin with opening remarks from both candidates. Each candidate will have 15 minutes. The timer is going to be down here, and you both know the colors and the codes and what we're working with here. Okay. Following the opening remarks, we'll go to questions from our audience. We'll do it National Press Club style. Many have already been submitted on cards. Thank you for being legible. I started needing reading glasses a couple years ago, and I just haven't made the jump yet. I need to go buy some. If you do want to get a question in, they can still be collected and they can still be delivered up to me. If something occurs to you over the next 30 minutes during the opening remarks, don't hesitate. Right over here, collecting the cards, handing out cards. Make sure you get your question in if you want to participate. Each candidate will answer a question. They'll have 2 minutes to respond to the questions. We can pose questions to both of them, or if one of the cards says specifically, this is for Congressman Perriello or this is for Jeff Clark, we'll direct the questions to that individual. Please take a moment right now to make sure that your cell phones and portable devices are turned off. Thank you very much. Please do not call out or yell during the event today. We will ask you to step outside if you don't respect the rights of your neighbors to hear. Thank you very much. And have we decided who will go first? You? Okay. Congressman Perriello has elected to go first in the opening remarks. Again, opening remarks from both candidates, 15 minutes each. Congressman Perriello, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Coy, for that introduction and for being here to moderate with us today. You're certainly a man made for radio, but we're happy to see you in person today. In all seriousness, I just want to thank the Senior Statesmen of Virginia for being a great organization that is trying to elevate the level of public debate. We've really enjoyed, I've enjoyed my interactions with the forum. They've been substantive, and particularly the hosting of this forum, which 2 years ago was the first debate I ever participated in. As I got into politics, and it was something where I was particularly pleased to be doing it here because my grandparents had been such an active part of the Senior Center, and I certainly want to thank the Senior Center for hosting, but also for all the great things they do for seniors in our community. And for everyone else in addition to that. The grandparents that I mentioned ended up spending their last couple years down in Gazebo Court, just a couple blocks away. And their daughter is here tonight, which is my mother, Linda Perriello, if you could give her a hand in the back. And I mention that only because at the first debate, she stood in the back and spent the vast majority of the forum actually in the hallway, too nervous to listen, and has suggested that this time she thinks she'll be able to actually be here and stand through it. But she is sitting right on the cusp, you'll notice, of the room. So we'll see. We'll see how that goes today. Just to address the issue of Senator Hurt's absence, I can just say, given how important this forum has been in the past, you know, it was an honor to sit up here with Congressman Good last time and exchange ideas. We had a spirited debate, and one thing that was great about a campaign with Mr. Good was there was never any question where he stood. We disagreed a lot of the time, but he was more than happy to stand up and say what his values were and his positions were, and it was a valuable forum. And no one's entitled to this seat. No one gets it for free. You got to fight for it. You got to make the case to the voters. There's been a lot of talk about discussion of televised debates and this, that, the other thing. It has been my strong position that Mr. Clark, as a credible candidate, as a candidate on the ballot, as a veteran and a business owner, and as a man who really, frankly, represents a lot of the views I hear from constituents a lot of the time, belongs in those debates. Senator Hurt's made it very clear that he will not allow Mr. Clark in the debates, and I think that that is a shame in terms of our democratic process, particularly a year when the economic stakes are so high. But given that he repeatedly refuses to do that, even after having pledged to the contrary, let me be very clear. I challenge Senator Hurt to 4 one-on-one televised debates so that voters get more than 30-second TV spots. 4 televised debates. The voters deserve that. The stakes are incredibly high this year in terms of the jobs, in terms of the deficit, in terms of wars we're fighting. And voters deserve more than hiding behind negative TV spots from your allies in the insurance industry and the oil industry. Voters deserve that in this economy. Again, I think it would be better if all candidates were allowed, but if that's not plausible, I think we need an opportunity on television for voters around the district to hear from that, and I hope Senator Hurt will not back out of that challenge. In addition, in any other forums, I am more than happy to continue forums with Mr. Clark, who has been, again, presenting a set of viewpoints, and we'll see that he and I disagree strongly on many issues, but we've also tried to do so respectfully and substantively, and hopefully that will continue, because, again, I think that's the kind of debate that we need. Let me just say a couple of things here in the opening remarks on substance. I think that there has been a tendency, and it's growing right now, to have a very short-sighted blame game about the economy. One side increasingly blaming President Obama, the other side pointing back to President Bush. My personal view is that our economic problems go deeper than any one president or any one party. We have had a 25-year decline of the middle class and working class in this country. We have seen jobs disappear under Republican presidents and Democratic presidents. We have seen, in my mind, elites in both parties believe that we can somehow get by without making anything, building anything, or growing things in America anymore. And it's simply not sustainable. We have in the past, and we can in the future, build things, make things, and grow things better than anyone else in the world. And this idea that if we just shore up the banks enough, if they just bail out the banks enough, that somehow that's going to trickle down to everyone else, I think was a misguided strategy on many levels. One of the reasons I got into this a couple years ago was that it seemed that that was the consensus in Washington. While I've been proud to stand with the president on issues where I agree with him, I have also been very critical of the economic team that I think misses this opportunity to see this as a moment where we have to rebuild manufacturing, construction, ag, and forestry in this country. The stakes are incredibly high, as I mentioned, because it's not just that we've seen an enormous number of jobs disappear. It's that the jobs that remain are paying less and less and less. The ability to survive on a wage job. And I think what we've seen increasingly is that a lot of people in the tops of both parties don't frankly care whether jobs created in Southern Virginia or Southern India. Now, we are all human beings of equal dignity, but every other country is playing for keeps except for ours. Just in the last month, China has become the greatest consumer of energy. They've committed to buying their energy production from only Chinese-made and manufactured sources. And they've gone after these concrete factories and other things to try to beat us to the efficiency game. I'm sick and tired of people saying, oh, well, why don't we just let India or China figure out energy first or figure out the next jobs thing first? Every day we wait, we continue to send American jobs overseas that could be the kind of things you could support a family with here. For a year and a half, I have been trying to build enough support, enough members, to try to push back on the Build It, Make It, Grow It in America agenda, and we've finally broken through. In the last 5 or 6 weeks, we've been able to hold the first serious hearings on China's manipulation of its currency and dumping practices. We've launched a national manufacturing strategy, as well as the American Trade Deficit Reduction Act. I've been fighting for Homestar and Rural Star that helps us renovate existing building stock, particularly in rural communities, that puts American construction crews to work. It puts American manufacturing to work because you're looking at the insulation, the double pane glass, the window film, and it's reducing electric bills for Americans at a time where the economic pinch is serious. I think right now is not a time for us to pull back in our shells and wait for China or other countries to beat us to the next set of jobs. Nor do I think this is something where, again, for those who think if we just give enough breaks to the people at the top, it will all trickle down from there. We have to be in this together. And that's what I've seen. That's what I went up there to do, was to shake up that conventional wisdom. And I think we're finally starting to get there. But we have a long way to go. When I look at whether it's the Charlottesville area, which has obviously continued to be relatively steady through this economic situation, though we certainly have seen foreclosures and real estate impacts, and when I go south of the James and see the part of our state that used to be the economic driver, but now have seen thousands of jobs go overseas under an idea that we'll send over our good-paying jobs, but we'll get cheap stuff in return, and somehow that will work out for us. I think right now in this year, we need people not to hide behind their party labels or their sound bites, but to come out and say, what is your plan for rebuilding the economy? And I believe it has to involve manufacturing, ag, and forestry. These are not things of the past. For all of our high tech, ag and forestry continues to be the biggest sector of the Virginia economy, with all the defense, with all the high tech, all of which are important. But we have to remember that it's important to have jobs, that someone who works hard and plays by the rules, they're going to be able to support a family. The second side of that for me that's been a guiding principle for the last year and a half is fairness, and particularly fairness for the middle class. We have a system that has been increasingly pinching out the middle class. There's a social safety net if you're in the most among the most marginal. If you're at the top end, you're probably doing all right, took a dip last year, but are back for the most part. And everyone in the middle has been getting crushed. And there are two sides of that. One is the jobs, your revenue stream in the home, either not having it there or being paid less and less. And the other is the cost stream. And what are those costs? Healthcare costs, housing costs, transportation, electric costs, and the costs of sending your kids to college. So what have we tried to do? We've tried to go up and reduce costs for healthcare. We've tried to go out and make it easier to have a home that's efficient and reduces your electric bill and diversifies our energy sources so we're not as vulnerable to those price shocks we've seen. Tried to make college more affordable with the biggest overhaul of student loan reforms that we've seen in a generation. And tried to help people through these tough times with tax breaks for 98% of Virginia families. These things are not magic wands that fix every problem, but it was an understanding that people were on tough times in the last year and a half and deserved a little bit of relief. I believe that was the right thing to do. So as I continue to fight the fights that I see in front of us, I think this is a time where we have to be thinking bold, not weak. And let me end with one last example of that, and that's the deficit. You're going to hear a lot from both parties this year about how committed they are to deficit reduction. If there's one thing I've learned in my brief time in Washington, it's that the only thing that's going to get this done is the bipartisan budget commission. Both parties have talked a good game while running up deficits. I've been somewhat quoted and sent around a video saying Congress will keep stealing from you unless you tie our hands, and people seem upset by that. I hate to tell you, it's the truth. Until we wake up and realize that both parties will continue to run up deficits unless we give them no other choice, that's the important truth we need to understand. Both will run those up unless we do pay-as-you-go legislation, so you can't do something unless you pay for it, and a bipartisan budget commission that demands an up or down vote in front of Congress. No amendments, nothing else. Anything else is going to go forward and make good sound bites and pointing fingers in each direction. This is based on the BRAC Commission, the Base Closing Commission, which was a very difficult thing after the Cold War. Everyone knew a lot of the bases need to be shut down and consolidated, but sure as heck no one wanted it to be the base in their district, nor did they want it to be in the base next to their district, nor did they even want it to be a base in their state. So if you put it through the normal process, everything gets killed in committee. Everything's got to be put on the table and looked at. That doesn't mean that I'll support anyone that comes up, but it sure as heck better have an up or down vote. So I hope this year, for all the rhetoric that gets pushed around, we understand that until we limit Washington's ability to run up those deficits, we will continue to see them. And probably the single most important way we could step in that direction is to demand that there's an up or down vote with nowhere to hide for the products of the Bipartisan Budget Commission. Those are the sorts of things I think we need to do. We need to, this group is called this is the Senior Center, and we're at the Senior Statesmen of Virginia debate. Statesmen, that's what we need, and statesmen step up and make tough decisions. Very few problems can be solved without making tough decisions. I'm willing to make them because I think it's what makes our country stronger. I'm proud to have done so, and I look forward to continue to do so in the challenges ahead, including this idea of once again building, making, and growing things in America. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Congressman Perriello. We now have opening remarks from independent candidate Jeff Clark. Jeff, you have 15 minutes. Go right ahead.
Thank you, Corey. I think last time I saw you, you were a bit more casually dressed, but it was great to have an opportunity, and it's always great to have an opportunity to be in Charlottesville and speak to the people of the 5th District. I do want to say that it's an honor to be here today at the Senior Statesmen's Forum. It's particularly important to my wife and I. We have, as part of our family household, my grandmother, who is 93, and my great aunt, who is 91, that live with us. So on a daily basis, we deal with senior issues, what their concerns are, how they've seen the country change from when they were young to now. They're a vast source of wisdom for us. It's an honor here today to have my parents. I think they're new seniors, kind of, not too far across the senior threshold, and today just happens to be my birthday, so exactly. So just about, or exactly 20 years from today, I will cross that threshold into being officially considered a senior. I do want to apologize because of my participation, that one of the other candidates couldn't be here today. I think it's important that everyone be able to hear from all the candidates. So everyone knows that it was not my intention to throw a wrench into the works or to somehow limit your ability to hear from everyone. My intention and my purpose in getting involved in the race was because I felt seriously there were things wrong and things happening in our country that were taking us down the wrong path. And I'm just a normal guy, a businessman, a father, a grandfather, who looks out and sees and the country heading in a direction that I'm not sure that we can sustain for a very long period of time. I'm not even sure we can sustain it for a short period of time. After this last election, I sat back and I started to think about, well, what's happening in this country? Why do we continue down this path? We had everyone come out and vote for hope and change. And let me take a minute to stop on that. I hear a lot of people try to ridicule folks for voting for hope and change. They say, well, how's that hope and change working out for you now? Ladies and gentlemen, as Americans, we should always hope that there's a better America, and we should always, on a daily basis, work for change. That is the system of government that our founders gave us. They gave us an opportunity to participate in forums just like this so we can exchange, we can disagree, and we can do so respectfully, and we can do it in a manner that communicates directly to the people. In a manner, our founders set in place the ability for us to have a nonviolent revolution every 2 years. We do it probably better than anyone else in the world. And I think that having Congressman Perriello here today, who has been willing to engage in this debate, I think it would be very easy for him, as a sitting congressman, maybe to not participate if the Republican candidate wasn't here. So I want to thank you, Congressman Perriello. I think that shows that he has a conviction that even the independent voices in the district should be heard. I will say it is a little intimidating sitting here with so many Perriello stickers staring you back in the face. But it's good to see conservatives in the room as well. It's good to see those people here today that have Robert Hurt stickers on. Folks, change in our country and a new direction for our government, it's essential that everyone participate, that everyone has a say. We have too many people that have become far too complacent in how our government runs. We have allowed things to happen and to occur in our name that we would now never allow for ourselves. We would now never allow to be done from business associates of ours or from our children. But yet we allow our politicians to constantly head down this road. I think anyone in Washington, even those that are currently sitting in Washington, believe that one of the largest problems we face is corruption. Corruption is at the very heart of what's happening. Congressman Perriello, he's right. He says a lot of people criticize him for saying if you don't tie our hands, the representatives will continue to steal from us. Actually, he's in pretty good company. It was Francis Bacon who said, in speaking of the responsibility of a legislator, he should bind his own hands, and not only bind his own hands, but bind the hands of those people he surrounds himself with. Oftentimes, these special interest groups, these special programs, these padding the pockets of the people that support these political parties necessarily aren't happening at the legislative process, but behind the scenes. And that's where congressmen and senators have to take the lead. They have to step forward. They have to control their staff. They have to say the buck stops here, and all too often right now in our country, that's not happening. I think one of the most powerful political platforms that any candidate can use is a platform of change. We almost hear that platform bannered about every 2 years. Change is a very powerful word in our society. It means a lot. But all too often what happens is we elect a new set of representatives, and we see no substantive change. We see changes in policies and positioning, and maybe a way to fund a particular program, or maybe a way not to fund another program. But what we don't see is a fundamental commitment to trying to reduce the size of the federal government. Even no matter who it is, whether it's the Republicans or Democrats, we constantly see a march towards a larger and more intrusive federal government that keep dipping into our daily lives, and it's becoming pervasive. We can't get away from it. The people of our country are intelligent, they are resourceful, and they need to understand that we are in a battle for the philosophical identity of our country. What type of people are we going to be? Are we going to be the type of people that pull ourselves up by our bootstraps, that get back to work, that look for ways to solve our own problems? I sit here at this table as part of the middle class. I sit here as a business owner who has a business that is teetering on survival because we have faced serious economic problems over these last 2 years. I know many businesses who are also teetering on survival. One push in either direction, whether it be taking more money out of their pocket or somehow suppressing the economic viability of the rest of the populace, is going to cause those businesses to enter into bankruptcy. We are at a critical point, and we have to decide for ourselves now, what type of people are we going to be? The most Americans that I know believe in a sense of self-reliance. And we have to ask ourselves, are we going to continue to just stick our hand out to the federal government looking for answers? Now, I think that both political parties have good intentions. No one really goes into office saying, I want to find a way to take advantage of the American people. It simply becomes part of the system. It becomes what happens. It's kind of almost a side effect. But what it is, it's a loyalty and a commitment to the parties first and not to the people. Every politician says, I am going to side with the people first and my party second. But unfortunately, in most cases, that doesn't happen. So maybe it's time that we move in a new direction. Albert Einstein said the definition of insanity is continuing to do the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. Ladies and gentlemen, the entire time that I've been politically aware, we have been turning power over from the Republican Party to the Democratic Party, to the Republican Party to the Democratic Party. Really, have we seen our country truly change for the better? Or do we see ourselves continually moving down that direction, that path that maybe could lead to destruction? We are becoming more dependent on foreign countries than we are being able to take care of ourselves. And I think maybe it's time for change. Just one or two independents in Congress. Maybe that's all it takes to help break that gridlock and maybe do something good for our country. And folks, that's really why I've decided to run. And I welcome the opportunity to be here today. And I hope that we'll be able to answer your questions, give you guys a good contrasting debate between conservative principles and more progressive principles. And I'm looking forward to it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Clark, very much. Even more.
Fantastic. Bring them on.
That's great. Any more? Raise your hand and we can collect them. Don't hesitate, really, at any point if you want to toss some into the mix. We have a number of questions, some fantastic questions, a whole variety of topics. Some of them repeat, so I've tried to combine some. We got some specifically for Mr. Clark, some specifically for Congressman Perriello.
Thank you, sir.
And so we'll try to just jump back and forth.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And we will go until about 3 o'clock. It's 2 o'clock right now, so we'll go until about 3 p.m. We'll start with this question. This event is held at the Senior Center, and it's sponsored by the Senior Statesman of Virginia. We'll go to both candidates, 2 minutes each. Your thoughts about what should be done with Social Security, and would you endorse privatizing Social Security investments? We start with Congressman Perriello.
I would not support privatizing Social Security, and I think that Social Security is obviously a promise we've made to our seniors. It's been an incredibly successful program. The challenges that we see are the kinds of challenges you want, which come from people living a lot longer than where it was expected at the beginning of the program. I think Social Security is not in the dire situation that is often portrayed in the media. I do think we need to make improvements to make sure it's sustained. I think Medicare has been a much bigger challenge in terms of sustainability than Social Security, and that's why we fought very hard to extend the solvency of Medicare. Under Senator Hurt's plan, Medicare starts going bankrupt in 2017. That's just 6.5 years. We've extended solvency at least to 2029 because we need to make sure that Medicare is there for our seniors. So when it comes to Social Security, we have to protect it, we have to guarantee it, and I think we've seen with the volatility in the market in the last few years just how dangerous it could be to privatize Social Security.
Thank you. We'll try to hold the applause during the right after each response so we have more time for questions. Mr. Clark, your thoughts on Social Security. You have 2 minutes.
I would be in favor of privatizing a portion of Social Security. A segment of the Social Security for younger people as they come through. We need to shore up Social Security to make sure that the promises that we've made to our seniors are we're able to follow through, that we're able to commit to. I think when people are talking about privatizing Social Security, they're not talking about the riskiest investments on Wall Street. They're talking about safe investments. And even in this political, even in this economic climate, there have been stocks and there have been investments that have done well. And I think that when we look at what can we do to give Social Security options of viability in the future, that can take us down that path. What we have is we continually have deadlines. Well, it will be solvent until this date. Well, we can extend our program till it's solvent until this date. We need to take measures to say, listen, we just need to set common sense principles in place where it's going to be solvent for the foreseeable future. All we're doing is simply putting off the inevitable. There has to be some alternatives and common sense alternatives. I don't think anybody, when they address privatization of Social Security, is doing so thinking that we should put these funds in risky investments. And so I would favor privatizing a portion of Social Security.
Thank you. We had a number of questions regarding the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and the budget for those wars and the Pentagon. We'll try to get to all of these, but let's start with this that hits a little closer to home. Can you each take 2 minutes to comment on the proposed closing of the Joint Forces Command in Norfolk, and is this an appropriate way to reduce the deficit? Clearly a major policy decision with a lot of political implications. We'll start with Jeff Clark.
Well, I'm from the Tidewater area originally, and I know how important the military is to the economy in that area. We see it shift almost on a monthly basis. If ships return, sometimes you have an influx in a single day of over 5,000 people. It will certainly harm the economy if Norfolk loses that base. But with that said, if we've exhausted every other opportunity to cut cost and to trim the deficit, then we have to be willing, even if it's going to affect our pocketbook, to look at making common sense decisions. Is closing the command the right decision? I'm not sure that I know that, but I do know that it will be an economic hardship on the people of the 5th District, and certainly I wouldn't encourage them doing it now. And maybe that's something we can look at in the future, but certainly it's going to affect Virginia as a whole. It's not just something that affects Norfolk. It's going to have far-reaching effects across our state. I would hope that right now they would keep the base open, reconsider it, and maybe look at it later from a more critical point of view and see maybe where else we can come up with savings. There are several hundred military bases in Europe right now. Why are we looking at closing bases here? Why can't we close some bases in Europe and start to bring those bases back here and start to instill or start to utilize the economic incentive of those bases? Think about what a single medium-sized military facility could do for Martinsville and Danville alone. It could have a tremendous economic impact. So I think when we're considering closing bases, it's not always looking at the bases or the large structures here at home. We can start saving money doing it small and medium-sized bases and maybe look at bringing some of those things back here to the United States.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. Congressman Perriello?
I would not support closing it at this time. I think, like with the base closing commission that I mentioned earlier, it's easier for people to understand shared sacrifice when it's getting us to an end goal like a balanced budget. And I think, particularly in this economy, we've seen some real potential hits to that part of the Commonwealth. There's also an issue about moving a carrier unit to Florida, which I think has more to do with Florida politics than necessarily national security. But those are decisions that we've gotten involved in. But I do think, and I would agree with Mr. Clark, I think we're seeing a real potential in our area, both around Central Virginia and Southern Virginia, for low-cost ways that some of the defense work can be moved out of the so-called blast zone and high-priority areas that currently exist. We've certainly seen a tremendous job just north of Charlottesville with a number of jobs coming in, and not just that those are good jobs that make our country safer, but also the tremendous effort that the Department of Defense and others have done to look at sustainability, to look at road design, to look at ways to minimize the eco footprint. We're really seeing very cutting edge stuff, and we are seeing more defense contractors come in around that. And I do believe there's the potential, once we've gotten that far down 29, to look a little further south into areas like Danville and Pennsylvania County, whether it's data storage or other things where you're looking at a much lower cost. So instead of looking at ways to outsource things overseas, maybe we can be insourcing some of this work to lower cost parts of the United States, areas that have been devastated by trade and other activities. So that having been said, I do think we've got to be honest about the threats that we face. They are not going away. They are not hypothetical. We have people who really do want to hurt this country. We have the issue of proliferation of nuclear and other high-risk materials. And I think we're going to need to see investments in our intelligence and our diplomatic presence, as well as hard military presence that continues in those efforts. The cheapest wars are the wars we don't have to fight in the first place because we've done the intelligence and diplomatic work. So I think this will continue to be an important area of investment for the United States, and I believe that Central and Southern Virginia is an area that can be part of that equation.
Thank you, Congressman Perriello. The next question is specifically for Mr. Clark. Jeff, what direction do you think Congress should go in regarding Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, I think when you look at Iraq and Afghanistan, you're really addressing two different scenarios. It's a totally different environment in Iraq than there is in Afghanistan. I think continuing the path that we have in Iraq right now is probably the appropriate measure. Things seem to be turning for the better there. There seems to be some stability in the government. But Afghanistan is a, by all accounts right now, a bit of a mess. I'm a father of a Marine who recently returned from his first combat tour of duty in Afghanistan, and I've had the opportunity. Thank you. And I've had the opportunity to hear from young Marines of their personal perspective from having served in Afghanistan. And right now, they lack a mission that has focus. It has really degenerated into nothing more than a drug interdiction program in a lot of cases. We don't have a specific targeted enemy, and we certainly are tying the hands of our soldiers and not allowing them to win this conflict. And in a way, we have drawn this out now for nearly 11 years. I think at this particular point, it's the largest conflict in American history, or the longest running conflict in American history. To me, I think it's a shame if we continue this strategy. We're asking our young men and women to risk their lives for political correctness, not asking them to risk their lives in the actual defense of our country. It's not important. It's not that it's not important to address terrorism, but we need to increase our efforts in intelligence. We need to either commit to fighting the war and winning this war, or we need to find alternative solutions. But right now, our strategy lacks focus. Our men and women are being put at risk, and truthfully, I'm not sure how we continue to afford funding this operation in Afghanistan. I mean, right now, for the most part, our operation in Afghanistan is being funded by other countries. And how do we ensure that we are there truly protecting our national interests if it's being funded and supported by other countries?
Thank you, Mr. Clark. We also have this question. I want to give Congressman Perriello a chance to respond to that topic as well. And specifically, we had a question. Congressman Perriello, why did you vote to continue funding for the war in Afghanistan?
The situation in Iraq, I think, is not a summer vacation spot, but I think we have reached some important strategic goals. I did not support that war in the first place. Once we had bogged ourselves down there, I thought there were strategic interests for getting out in the right way, and I think we have done so. We've gotten ourselves into a position to do that, and we have drawn down combat troops pretty much on schedule, which is a pretty impressive effort. Afghanistan is a mess, and I voted last year and this year to demand a strategy for victory and a plan for withdrawal. However, in the meantime, as those failed, I think it is important to continue to fund our troops as they are there. We are in this. We have real strategic interests and concerns in the region, and I'll mention three. One, a destabilized nuclear Pakistan is a near existential threat to the United States. It is a very serious threat. Now, people can agree or disagree on whether our actions there are helping to stabilize or destabilize, but I think there's general agreement of how serious that strategic interest is. Second, a Taliban-led central government with links to al-Qaeda in Afghanistan is also a threat. That is distinct from necessarily varying degrees of seriousness of how tight those links are, how much of the country they control, et cetera. A third strategic threat for us in the region is getting bogged down in a quagmire. Afghanistan has been a graveyard of empires through the centuries, and it would be hubris for us to think that we are not capable of falling prey to that. I think General Petraeus is probably the greatest military mind of a couple of generations, and I certainly want us to succeed there. My concern from the beginning has been as follows. We have focused almost entirely on how big the lever should be when it's the fulcrum that's rotten to the core. More troops or less troops is the question of the lever, but we're there as a partner of an utterly corrupt and rotten government. Some of you know I was there doing research for parts of 05 and 07, and it became clear at that point that this was a kleptocracy, and to the extent that we were seen as partners with these thugs and warlords, it undermined the unbelievably great work that our troops we're doing over there. If we cannot figure out a way to change the political dynamic on the ground, the military strategy, in my mind, cannot succeed. The Bush administration made a huge mistake by imposing a constitution that did not make sense for Afghanistan. It was centralized, which made more sense in Iraq, which had a history of centralized government, than it did in Afghanistan, which has no such history. If we make some bold political moves there, I think there is still room to succeed in a timely basis. But I do believe Congress has a duty to hold them accountable, and that's why I've pushed for those amendments to demand a strategy for victory in the region.
Thank you, Congressman Perriello. Keeping on that same topic, in a related issue, and we'll go to we'll stay with Congressman Perriello on this. How do you propose to address the needs of our new veterans facing the difficulties of the wars and their service to this country? And I would just simply add in the new veterans and the existing veterans as well. Congressman Perriello.
Well, the greatest honor I've had is serving on the Veterans Affairs Committee. It is not only a great honor because we get a chance to serve those who served our country, but it's also one of the last remaining bipartisan places in Washington where we have been able to come together and get things done. We've been able to deliver a lot of results for returning veterans. Before I got there, Senator Webb had helped pass the new modern GI Bill, and what we did over the last year was make sure it was implemented as smoothly as possible, and we have 250,000 new veterans who are enrolled in four-year colleges right now under the new GI Bill. We've also seen, though, unprecedented unemployment for returning OEF and OIF veterans. And many say, hey, you know, four-year college is great for some. I'm looking to get in the workforce in 12 months, making a wage I can support a family on. So I've been fighting to allow more GI Bill benefits to apply to technical training, technical certificates, trade schools, and other things that people can get in and out of in 6 to 18 months. We've also looked at the issue of PTSD and suicide rates and forcing the VA to have a stronger screening process as people are doing the outtakes. In the healthcare arena, we've worked hard to start bringing the healthcare to the veteran instead of the veteran to the healthcare, particularly in rural communities, using telemedicine, using community-based outreach clinics and other traveling facilities so that people are not driving a huge number of hours to get to the specialized care, though they continue to have that option if they so choose. We've also worked where we've seen businesses become increasingly hesitant to hire a veteran, where it used to be the first thing someone wanted to put on their resume. We've seen people leaving it off because of concerns about multiple deployments, getting called back up, and mental and physical issues. So we've been working with business leaders on tax credits and other ways to ensure that people are looking out to hire a veteran, as well as making it easier to start a veteran-owned business. But we also see a group of Korean and Vietnam-era vets coming into the VA system for the first time because of the down economy and because of aging. And we also want to make sure that those who have often been forgotten in the VA system are getting their due. We fought hard, and after years and years, we were actually able to finally get the funding for the backlog of Agent Orange exposure cases so that those who've been fighting the VA for years and are late in life will certainly have the recognition and the support that they need. So we need to continue to make sure we respect and fight for all of our veterans. Thank you,
Congressman Perriello. Jeff, the same topic, 2 minutes, veterans issues, and the specific question was about the new veterans that are coming into the system.
Well, I think the new veterans we really do have to consider, and it's not just what happens on the ground when the veterans come home, but as Congressman Perriello just mentioned, that the VA is seeing an influx now of Vietnam-era vets who are turning to the VA. A lot of these young men and women, while they're participating in these engagements overseas, experience bumps, bruises, things that don't bother them when they're young. But as many of us know, as you begin to age, those things become more and more relevant. We not only have to address what's happening when these young men come home, we have to be proactive in making sure that the VA is ready in 15 or 20 years to handle the ailments, the conditions, the problems that these young men and women are going to look to come have addressed when these things become more relevant to them, when they start to feel those aches and pains, when they start to question, why can't I hear? What's wrong with my vision? How come I have numbness in my hand? These are all things when you're a young man or a young woman that maybe you can overlook for a little while. But I think that we've seen it in history, and I think that we've seen it with the Vietnam vets, and we have to be very aware that with this protracted engagement, that the number of veterans that are going to be seeking care in the next 15 or 20 years is going to explode, and the VA and the system is going to have to be ready. We do have to work hard to try to make sure that these young men and women have jobs when they return home. My son has another few years in, but if he comes back to Danville, what are his prospects when he comes back to Danville? Is he going to be able to find a job? Is he going to have to move? They're going to fight for our country. What are we doing here to fight to establish economic independence? What are we doing to ensure that we are having a place that's safe for them to come back to, a place where they can come in, walk back into the workforce, and be productive members of the civilian society? They've done their duty as military men and women, and now they deserve to come back to a place and to areas of our district here that have some sense of economic viability. And I'm not sure that that economic viability can only be found at the feeding trough to the federal government.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. This question is for Congressman Perriello, and I read it right off the card. You voted for three of the most unpopular and biggest spending bills in history: stimulus, health care, cap and trade. How do you defend these votes as in the best interest of 5th District constituents?
A year and a half ago, I came into office for the first time, and there was a $3 trillion contraction in the economy. Economists from Reagan's team, both President Bush's, McCain's advisors, as well as Clinton's and Obama's, all agreed that we were on the verge of a Great Depression. Adults in the room had to come together and make some tough decisions to save us from going into a depression. It was a package that was 40% tax cuts, 40% emergency funding to states and localities who otherwise would have had to jack up your taxes, and 20% investment in infrastructure, research and development, and other things. Now, I did fight for a different kind of stimulus that would have been a longer-term construction-oriented build-out of rebuilding our competitive advantage. But when it came down to whether to support this or not support this, we knew what the stakes were. The Chamber of Commerce supported it. Most of the business community supported it. We have to keep in mind the kind of economy that we were talking about. And a group of economists from across the spectrum last week came out and said that they believe this prevented the second Great Depression in American history. So if I look back on that and say, were we able to prevent a Great Depression, I think that that's the right thing to do. Now, did we do enough to rebuild America's competitive advantage, which is what I thought a really visionary stimulus would have done? No. I believe it was held back by the idea of those who think we just need to get back to 2006 and everything will be all right. I think our problems go deeper than that about rebuilding our competitiveness in the world, and I would have liked to see more of that. In terms of the energy vote, every day we wait. Every day we wait, we just send jobs to China and India. Every day we wait, Chavez gets stronger, Ahmadinejad gets stronger. I think it is a horrible insult to our country to have no national energy policy. Now, I hear this from manufacturers down in Southside who say, we would love nothing more than to build anything, but if we got to build things that made our country safer, bring it on. And I talk to investors who say, we've got a lot of cash, we're willing to invest in energy, but we're not going to do it in America until America gets serious about energy. We know China's serious about energy. And what did we use? We used a free market approach that was developed by Republicans. The cap and trade system was developed by the first President Bush and produced probably the most efficient and effective environmental law in history to reduce acid rain. It was supported by John McCain. And the worst kind of partisanship is when you develop an idea and you say it's great, and the second Democrats agree with you, you suddenly have to decide it's a bad idea. This is right to make our country strong. It's right for jobs. It's the right thing to do.
Thank you, Congressman Perriello. Jeff, the next question, we had a few questions, actually, about a half dozen questions regarding your status as an independent candidate. One question said specifically, Mr. Clark, are you running as a true independent or as a member of the Tea Party? And along those same lines, someone else asked, do your views reflect those of Sarah Palin's? If not, how do they differ?
Well, believe it or not, I've had this question posed more than once, so I'm more than ready to answer it. Let me. I am a member of the Danville Tea Party. But I have tried to make it perfectly clear from the very beginning of my run that I do not consider myself a Tea Party candidate. The Tea Party is made up of a group of people. There are many Tea Party people who support Senator Hurt. Believe it or not, there are some conservative Democrats that participate in the Tea Party. I know we have a couple in our Danville Tea Party alone. And it's a organization that is really being fostered and brought together by a sense of an out-of-control federal government. So I'm not technically the Tea Party candidate, but I do believe in a lot of their values, and I do believe, as far as my principles, that they fall in line with how the Tea Party, or with the principles the Tea Party wants to bring forward, or and why they were formed. Now, as for Ms. Palin, I can't say that I agree with all of her issues. I think that maybe her heart's in the right place. She's out there. She's certainly a powerful force. She has the ability to unite people. But just like other political figures, she also has the ability to be divisive. And I think that it's a I welcome her participation. I think that she is being embraced by a lot of people because of what she seems to represent, a sense of the normal person, someone that you could be talking to, next door. Now, in Charlottesville and other places, maybe that's not popular, but she has a lot of popularity in this country. And, I welcome her participation. I can't say we agree on everything, but I think she's important for the Tea Party movement, and I think she's important for the movement in this country that wants to see limited government.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. We also had a number of questions regarding health care, and we're going to come at this from a bunch of different angles. But let's start with, we'll stay with Mr. Clark, Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli of Virginia has made national news filing the suit against health care and will challenge that in court. Do you support the Attorney General's actions? And give us your thoughts on this debate and the related health care issues with the new legislation.
Yes, I support our Attorney General's efforts. I think it's important. I know that a lot of people think that mandating the idea of people purchasing insurance is something that really kind of is offensive to them. I'm not in favor of anyone telling me what I should buy or what I need to have. That is up to me, up to my family, and I think a lot of Americans agree with that. I think when you look at the current health care plan with the administration, they're trying to justify mandating Americans buy health insurance. Well, they're saying, well, it's a tax. Well, it's not a tax. It's not a requirement. We're not demanding. We're just going to tax that portion of it. But yet they don't want to claim it as a tax. So I think there's a lot of struggle on both sides right now to try to find a way, especially on the Democratic side, to justify mandating every single person in this room buy a health care policy. People buy health care policies when they see it as a benefit to their family and to themselves. There are many small business people who do not purchase health insurance, do not see the need at a particular time, especially if they're younger. And I think it's irresponsible for the federal government to step in and say, you have to buy something. And that's basically what it is. You have to buy something. That is a slippery slope. And where does it end? Because we want to see GM be successful, because we're all stockholders in General Motors right now? Can the government mandate that we all buy the new Chevy Volt? Where will they draw the line at the mandates? It's certainly for the good of the country. I mean, if GM does well, we get paid back. But we have to draw the line somewhere. We have to be responsible for ourselves, and we have to be able to make these decisions for ourselves. And I think that his fight is on target, and it's justified, and I applaud him for it.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. Same question and topic to Congressman Perriello.
On the question of the lawsuit, I support the Attorney General's right to bring the suit, but I think he will lose. I think he's arguing from the Articles of Confederation, not the U.S. Constitution. And I think that what we need is to let this play out in the courts. I think it's absolutely right for some conservatives to make the argument, make the case. I think it's at odds with the jurisprudence of even very conservative Supreme Courts. But that's what that third branch is for, is to play these issues out. We have a number of contentious issues going right now. And I think when individuals or states feel like they need to bring the case, that should go to the judiciary. Again, I don't think you had a lot of case law to cite on it, but that can play out in that direction. In terms of the issue, the primary issue, I disagree with Mr. Clark. The libertarian notion is that my right to move my fist stops at the edge of your nose. And when we're talking about this, what we're really talking about is a $1,400 tax cut to people with private insurance because they're paying $1,400 extra every year to cover the uninsured. That's not fair. That's the equivalent of the edge of your nose to me. When you're talking about, I don't have that choice. I don't have the choice of whether I'm getting stuck with my private insurance with paying that hidden tax. So to me, this is a hidden tax that we are cutting for those who are responsible and play by the rules to make sure that that people are part of the system. Now, we've also gone out and said we're going to make sure that we find ways to make that affordable, which are with tax cuts to small business and to individuals, so that a family making up to $88,000 a year can get over $5,000 in tax cuts and affordability credits for the insurance. The tax cuts to small business are immediate. On my recent Main Street tour, I met with countless businesses who said, I'm not going to pay federal tax this year because of the health care bill, which goes retroactive to January 1 in terms of covering 35% of their health care premiums as a tax credit. So, you know, if my car gets swiped by someone through no fault of my own, I don't think I should have to get stuck paying the bill for that. And that's small compared to the bills we're talking about in the health insurance industry.
Thank you, Congressman Perriello. We'll go to Mr. Clark next, and we got a series of questions regarding same-sex marriage and the Defense of Marriage Act. One reads, should the federal government have a role in determining whether state governments permit same-sex marriage? Do you support repeal of the Defense of Marriage Act? We also had one question that said, do you believe life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness includes gay marriage? Mr. Clark.
Well, in my opinion, this is one of the most contentious issues that we face. It's very sticky as to how you approach this. We had this discussion coming up in the car. How to address gay marriage. As a man who's been married 25 years, I guess my own opinion is that marriage is between a man and a woman. But I also realize that there are constituents in the 5th District that don't view things that way. I've had many conversations with people who are gay or lesbian, and they have addressed concerns. They've told me where their concerns lie as far as civil unions, and how do we come to a common sense solution that can make everyone happy? Is our civil unions the answer, or is working to, make the legislation stronger or the message stronger to say that marriage has to be defined between a man and a woman? Is that the answer? I think that you have a lot of argument on both sides. I think that when you look at it, I think maybe the easiest way to handle the situation is get the state out of it altogether in making determinations about what is marriage and what isn't marriage. Allow the churches and religions to do that. I mean, how else can we actually justify and move things in accordance with the Constitution when we address this issue? I mean, it is a matter of, do we want to discriminate based on people's choices? We don't have to agree with people's choices, but certainly we have to recognize the right that they shouldn't be discriminated against as far as receiving housing, receiving benefits, tax cuts, or in the case of married couples, a tax penalty. But these are things that they see as a necessity to provide for their lifestyle. And I think that we need to try to find common sense solutions where we can work with both parties and listen to people themselves, not the extremists on either side, but listen to those people who just want to live their lives and be left alone and come to some type of common sense solution.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. Congressman Perriello?
I think that we're continuing to see states take different approaches to this, and I think that that's working its way both through state legislatures and through the courts. I think that as a matter of contract law, the discrimination does not make sense. As a question of marriage, I agree with Mr. Clark that I think we need more God and less government in our marriages. And I think that when we look at the real threats to marriage right now, we have the cultural concerns of a culture of instant gratification that we see throughout all our culture. I want it for me right now. And we also see the issue of economic hardship. There's no question that in this economy we see a tremendous amount of pressures on families. Whether you've lost a job and you're relying on unemployment benefits in a tough economy and you don't know when those might run out, or whether you've held on to your job but you don't know when you might lose it, maybe your house is in foreclosure or it's threatening, these tend to put enormous pressure on families. So I think one of the real things we can do is try to make it a little easier to get by in the middle class in this country. And if we give that kind of support to families, I think, you know, people can figure out the rest.
Thank you, Congressman Perriello. We had a number of questions regarding, obviously, a historically contentious issue in America called a right to life or a woman's right to choose abortion. We had one question that goes to Congressman Perriello. Please explain what the new health care bill says about abortions and funding. There have been arguments on all sides of this issue, and we need to know what the bill says rather than what opponents claim that it says. And along those same lines, do you support the government making the decision whether or not a woman carries a pregnancy to term or not? And we can have both candidates respond to these, to this issue.
The bill is very clear, as is the executive order. There is no federal funding for abortions under this plan, period. And those who are trying to make partisan points on this issue, I think, have a lot to answer for. That has been a tough pill to swallow for many people in this country, including many of my supporters. I think this is probably considered one of the greatest losses for the pro-choice community in a generation. But I think there are a lot of other things in there that are so important to women. You're talking about getting rid of the idea of being a woman being a pre-existing condition, the idea that women have to pay 45% more for health care. But we also fought for things that I think brought some people from both sides of this divide together. The idea of requiring pre- and postnatal care to be covered is a huge issue in terms of reducing the number of abortions. It's also a huge issue in terms of economic pressure on a family. A pregnancy can easily rank up, even if you have insurance, $7,500 out of pocket. And if you're struggling as a young family, that can be a huge barrier and burden. We expanded adoption tax credits and other things to try to, again, bring people together on this issue. I think it is not fair to ask taxpayers, federal taxpayers, to pay for abortion. And the Hyde Amendment has protected that for a number of years, and we have fought hard to expand that. And again, I recognize that those in the choice community are very upset about this, and the concerns are there. In some ways, this hasn't just held the line. It has expanded beyond that. So we're not just talking about public plans or public dollars. That standard is now being extended into private plans for the first time under this bill through the exchange, and I know that many have that concern. But I did make the pledge to my constituents that I would insist on no federal funding for abortions, and I did go up and fight for that. And I understand that people on both sides ended up upset by it, but that standard was met in the health care bill.
Thank you, Congressman Perriello. Mr. Clark?
I think when you readdress this issue, especially when we look at the health care bill, without question, and even Ms. Sebelius came out recently and said the high-risk pools, yes, that money could be used to fund abortions. So without question, it's there. Is it explicitly stated? No. It's not. But that's the problem with the way legislation is written in Washington. When we look at the Constitution and the first 10 amendments, they were very concise and short. We have a 2,000-page health care bill, ladies and gentlemen. And no matter how well-intentioned Congressman Perriello was in trying to ensure there were no federal funds for abortion, evidently, somehow, something slipped through the crack. And there is a ability for federal funds to go towards abortion. Now, certainly this is a contentious issue in our country. And I think that when you look at the idea of using federal funds or tax money that comes from the entire spectrum of the country to fund abortions, I think that it's inappropriate. I think that this is an issue for the states and not an issue for the federal government. I think when you, Congressman Perriello has been quoted in saying that he is in support, he is a pro-life candidate, and I do believe that that's where his convictions lie, but I think it has also been quoted as saying that he wouldn't work to repeal Roe v. Wade. I mean, that's a bit of a contradiction. That is the legal precedent that gives a woman a right to an abortion, a legal interpretation of our Constitution that many would disagree that it actually exists. We've had many bad legal precedents in our country's history, and when we have one that isn't working effectively, we need to work to overturn that. And we can't talk about being pro-life, we have to take actions to be pro-life. We have to do due diligence when we're looking at legislation. And Congressman Perriello did mention the executive order. Executive order does not trump legislation. Executive order isn't going to, President Obama can't come in and say, I hereby today void the Constitution by executive order. He can't do it. I'm not saying he would, but I'm saying that power doesn't exist. And the ability to use executive order to ensure that no federal funds go to abortion, I don't think is ironclad enough. I think there needs to be strict language, and we need to address specifically these high-risk pools that could allow money to go towards abortion. And I hope that Congressman Perriello realizes that maybe this high-risk pool is a gap and would work with other congressmen in a bipartisan way to fill that and close it to ensure that no federal funds go towards abortion.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. Thank you. We'll stay with Mr. Clark. We have a number of members of this audience who are big fans of the fair tax. So your thoughts on this concept and the best-selling book, and just to respond to that idea, and then we'll go to Mr. Perriello.
Well, I think that I'm, of course, a fan of reforming our tax code. We have an out-of-control, almost an impossible-to-understand tax code. We see these recently in the passing of this jobs bill. One of the promises is we're going to close that tax loophole that businesses are using to send jobs overseas. Folks, the legislation wasn't designed to give them the tax loophole. There are people out there who are geniuses that find these things. So our tax system is in dire need of reform. It needs to be simplified. It needs to be something everyone can understand, and it needs to be something that only the wealthy can pay to be able to avert. You know, and I do believe in the fair tax. I think that it's an easy system to demagogue. I think people can say, you know, if you quote it as an inclusive versus an exclusive tax, you can say it's a 30% tax. But if you quote it as an inclusive tax, like you quote the income tax, I think that it makes sense. When people understand that if you add a 23% sales tax, but you eliminate all other taxes on the federal level, that could lead to a simplified tax code. And in that process, in the way the fair tax is designed, it's designed to completely eliminate the tax burden on the poor. Anyone who spends money, anyone who goes out and buys a $5 million yacht, they're going to have to pay for that purchase. Anyone who's buying the necessities of life, whether it be diapers, milk, any other type of food, they're going to get a credit every month according to the plan. Now, is it a plan that can be easily implemented? No. It's a plan that would require the implementation of a constitutional amendment that would bar adding additional income taxes on the federal government level. So it is a long-term goal, but I think that it is a well-researched goal and has been implemented and used in other places. In the meantime, I am in favor of finding any way in working in a bipartisan manner to simplify the tax code. I don't think anyone, no matter what side of the aisle you're on, is happy with the tax code. But I think that when you look at it, when you research it, and when you read it, and I encourage those people who maybe aren't fair tax proponents, take a moment to read the book, read it with a critical eye, and look at the objections. And there's nothing wrong with objecting to the fair tax, but just look at it in a fair manner. And I've read several books on the issue, and I would love to see the fair tax implemented because I just think it would be a fair system across the board for everyone.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. Congressman Perriello, the fair tax?
Well, Senator Hurt and I have both come out against the fair tax, and I think that there are some things that are positive about it, but I ultimately cannot support it. I think the upside is simplicity and border adjustability. I think our trade issues are enormous. We have a number of things in our tax code that encourage jobs going overseas that have to be fixed. I think along with bad trade deals, we have bad tax deals that help ship American jobs overseas. We've been fighting to close a number of those, and I think it does have those upside elements. Again, I'll continue to look at any comprehensive tax reform. The analysis that I've seen that I consider the most credible suggests that to be truly revenue neutral, you would be looking at more like 35 to 40. Some people were upset when I used the 23 cents figure before, but I think that's being kind to the fair tax, not harsh on it. But again, I think that people are engaging in this debate in good faith because of a frustration with the tax code. And I think that the other thing to think about is what to do in the meantime. time. I think it is unlikely, as Mr. Clark has noted, that you would see this, whether you're for it or against it. What we have done is, in the last years, I've supported tax cuts for 98% of Virginia families, tax cuts for small business, including forward depreciation, freeze on capital gains for small business, a quadrupling of the tax deduction for starting a small business, and the 35% tax credit retroactive to January 1 for health care premiums for small business. I believe that the middle class and small business owners are the ones that have been getting pinched in the system the most, and these are real tax cuts that have made a difference, and will continue to support tax relief for those. My other opponent, Senator Hurt, supported a very large tax increase in Virginia. Then he took a no-tax pledge, and now he's already endorsed policies that would raise taxes on 15,000 small businesses just in our district alone. Now, I go out and talk to small business owners, and they're not looking for that tax increase that Senator Hurt has supported. He's also come out against the outsourcing loophole, or against closing the outsourcing loophole that sends jobs overseas, and has said after 10 years of representing Southside Virginia as thousands of jobs went overseas that he didn't really have an opinion about free trade. So here in an area that has lost so many jobs to the global economy, he has no position on trade, and he supports this outsourcing loophole that rewards jobs for going overseas. I've been delivering tax cuts for middle class and small business, and making sure the tax code rewards those businesses that stick with us here in America.
Thank you, Congressman Perriello. The next question will stay with you. Just yesterday, the House voted to pass a bill to fund 160,000 teachers plus other services. As you just referenced, the bill was partially paid for by closing a loophole that gave tax credits to companies for outsourcing jobs overseas. Did you support that vote? Why or why not? And then to Mr. Clark, would you have supported that vote? Why or why not?
I did support the vote. There were a number of votes yesterday, including sending more border agents down to the border. The main bill was one that said, you know, we have to start having some priorities here. And we did cut programs. And frankly, they were programs that a lot of Democrats liked, including some reductions in the food stamp program. Because we're at the beginning of a school year and there are 160,000 teachers out there, and we've got a lot of schools in those, our students in those classrooms. So we said we're not going to do new spending. We're going to make some tough choices, and that's what we've been hearing from people, to make sure that we don't sell out education. Because right now, if we're going to compete in the global economy, making sure our kids have a top-notch education is one of the most important things. We also have 1 million baby boomers retiring as teachers, and we need to be sending a signal to our best and brightest young graduates that teaching is a profession that we value. It's something to go into. This was important. So we did make some difficult decisions. The closing the outsourcing loophole is a huge victory. It's something I've fought for the last year and a half, and others have fought for a long time. We tried a lot of different ways to get the Senate to act on it. And if there's one thing I've learned in the last year and a half, it's that the Senate is a huge part of the problem. But leaving that inside baseball aside, it was good to see that after years of hype from the parties about this, those of us who were there fighting away and fighting away and fighting away for American workers, for American manufacturing, that we were able to do that. So I was proud to step up and say this is something that is going to actually reduce the deficit. We're making tough decisions about spending. We're closing a loophole that made no sense in the first place to reward outsourcing of American jobs. And we're doing it to save firefighters, police officers, and teachers. That was a good day.
Thank you, Congressman Perriello. Same question to Mr. Clark.
Well, no, I wouldn't have supported the jobs bill, but I think this brings us to an important point. When we look at this tax loophole that was closed, we need to look at the original intention of that tax loophole, or what became a loophole. The legislation was originally written to protect businesses from being taxed twice, but like our tax code, what happens is what's written isn't actually what occurs. With a lack of due diligence and a complicated tax system, we are going to see things like this time and time again. Now, when we look at the funding, I know many people in this room probably are familiar with the old Popeye cartoon, you know, and remember character Wimpy? I'll gladly pay you tomorrow for a hamburger today. Well, when we look at what's happening with our government's fiscal responsibility, it's the wimpy system of financial management. I will gladly pay you next year for $26.1 billion today. $11 billion is supposedly going to be cut from this tax loophole. That quite doesn't cover the entire program. $7 billion is supposed to come from food stamp cuts in 2014. I don't think that that's really going to happen. And there's other cuts. There's cuts to renewable energy programs and tax credits and things like that to justify this. This is a shell game being played by men in suits in Washington, D.C., that if any parent were to walk around and take their children and point to these guys playing this type of fiscal irresponsible game, a con game, we would point it out to try to educate them, but yet somehow we continue to allow this. Our current legislature has two things in common with WMPE. Number one is they're broke. They don't have the money to pay for what they want today. And number two, they have no intention of paying for it if they don't have to. Even Our Vice President Biden came out and said, oh, listen, we'll find other money for this. We'll find other ways to do this. We won't have to depend on these things. It's not a bad thing to close tax loopholes. But what I'm saying is, when do we draw the line? When do we say enough? When do we stop allowing ourselves to be manipulated by fear, engaging in budgetary terrorism? Listen, usually we see it on the local and state level. What is it? Teachers, police, firemen. Anybody knows what always comes next? Garbage pickup, because we know those things affect us, and man, they get us going. And they know that if they can write that home and send it home, they can get us to accept more irresponsible behavior. And that's exactly what we're doing. It's not that the goals aren't noble, but the fact of the matter is the truth isn't there. Most of this money is going to go into the pockets of unions. Most of this money is going to encourage and reward additional fiscal irresponsibility on the part of the states and local governments. At some point, we have to draw the line.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. We'll stay with Mr. Clark. In the Citizens United decision, the Supreme Court removed limits on corporate spending on election campaigns. Number one, how are you responding to this in your campaign for Congress? And number two, what are your thoughts on this decision, good or bad?
Well, first of all, trust me, I'm not benefiting from a corporate donation. So, you know, most of this expense for running in this campaign is coming out of my own pocket. But I think when you're talking about issues of free speech, I think that it's always good to allow people to participate across the board. I think that opening up and allowing corporations to donate money, if it's done in a responsible manner, is okay. I think when you limit corporations from being able to donate but do nothing to restrict unions from donating, what you have is you set up an imbalance between the political parties. I think when you look at it across the board, it's not Republicans or conservatives that benefit most or only from corporate investments. Corporations really don't have necessarily a political identity. They are willing to donate to whoever they think is going to benefit their interest. And what happens is the people have to hold corporations accountable. We think that corporations have souls. They don't. Corporations are money-making entities, and people have to ensure fiscal responsibility and to make sure they're not using that ability to donate to political campaigns in an irresponsible manner. But if we limit corporations, we should equally be limiting unions on who they can donate to and how much they can donate. Is it fair for a union to collect dues and make it a determination that they're going to send the majority of their money to the Democratic Party, or let's say it was the Republican Party, if it did not reflect the views of their members? These members, in a lot of cases, are being held hostage. Their money's being taken from them and used for in an irresponsible manner. I say if it's fair for the unions, it should be fair for the corporations as well.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. Congressman Perriello?
Citizens United was a disastrous decision. It was an example of very smart people reaching a very dumb conclusion based on being, I think, you know, in an ivory tower instead of on the ground. I don't meet people very often who say, we just need more corporate influence in our democracy. And, you know, Washington, as you've noted, is broken. And one of the biggest reasons it's broken is because of the way and that people finance campaigns and the amount. And it was bad enough when politicians were thinking about, wow, this vote might cost me a $50,000 fundraiser or, you know, cost you this or that. Now these guys are writing $1 million checks, $50 million checks. Y'all have all had to sit through $1.3 million of negative ads about me paid for by the insurance companies, by the coal companies, by the oil companies. We've gotten most of them taken down for being verifiably false, but then they just go up the next day with a new one. This is not promoting our democracy. And where I come come from, if you have a position, you're willing to put your name on it, you're willing to stand up. And just like you shouldn't skip a debate to make the case to the voters, if you're wanting to put up an ad, you should say at the end who the heck you are. This is just the minimum standard of decency in an election, and be willing to stand by that. That's what the Disclose Act was about, which I fought for and supported. I think that's the bare minimum to get us back to where we were. So I think that the level of corruption we see is related to the fact that I think both parties are increasingly responsive to Wall Street and not Main Street. And I think areas like Southern Virginia pay the price for that. Republicans talk a good game. Democrats talk a good game. But when the bailouts come, when they came under before I got up there in 07, it wasn't running Main Street. It was Wall Street coming to Washington and saying, you will give us a bailout. It wasn't government going to Wall Street. Wall Street came to Washington, its friends in both parties, and said, you will bail us out. Then you get on a vicious cycle of the taxpayers' dollars being at play and everything else. That didn't come about because of a government takeover. This was still under President Bush, and it was because of the influence there. So I think this is one of the greatest threats to our democracy, but it's also one of the greatest threats to capitalism, because what it's doing is it's rewarding what was successful 20 years ago, or rewarding who can write the biggest checks, when we know that two out of every three new jobs in our economy comes from a small business. We know that the innovation, the entrepreneurship, is coming from small businesses, and they are getting choked out by exactly this sort of thing, and we need to fix it.
Thank you, Congressman Perriello. Thank you. We have a few minutes left. We've got about 7 or 8 minutes left. We had a number of questions regarding the environment, and I'll just throw it out as a general topic and get you all to respond to it. And we'll start with Congressman Perriello. One person wanted to know how we deal with climate change. Someone else wanted to know about mountaintop removal mining. And then we also had somebody that said, with a political environment that just says no, how can we say yes to environmental protection? Your thoughts on this topic?
On the issue of the energy sector, I think the Republicans have said no to American jobs. I think that the failure to act, the sheer cowardice that it took of them to stand up and say that they were happy to allow Chavez and Ahmadinejad and petro dictators around the world to win, to allow Chinese manufacturing to beat American manufacturing. I mean, what hole do you have to be living in to not realize these are the jobs of the next 25 years, and that every year that we wait, more of those jobs go overseas, more of that investment goes overseas. This is a time America doesn't sit back and say, well, let's let other people do it. We do it better than anyone else. We get there first, and we can still do that in energy. And we need a national energy policy in order to send that market signal to let capitalism do its work. The private sector will do it if we send that signal. Just look at what we've been able to do in the 5th District over the last year. We're working with some of the biggest dairy farmers to turn cow manure into power. So instead of paying to subsidize milk, to clean up the bay and everything else, we're making an investment in an anaerobic digester. We're working with poultry farmers. We're working with the people that make window film in Martinsville that they're actually exporting to Asia, helping to cut people's electric bills in half. We're looking with advanced battery technology, which when we came into office, America had 3% of that market. We're projected to have 40% of that market by next year in advanced batteries. Looking at the next generation of cars, looking at biofuels. I want us to make it here in America. We have gas stations in my district, in our district, where instead of you driving up and getting 3 cents on your dollar to stay in the community, 93 cents of your dollar stays in the community because it's supporting local farmers as well as the refiners as well as the manufacturers. This is how we're going to have to rethink if we're going to outcompete China. And they're not waiting around to see if we're going to do it. So I absolutely think we need to be bold in the energy sector. I think that that when the Senate killed that, led by the Senate Republicans, they were popping champagne in a lot of very scary places around the world. And we've got to be more patriotic than that, more courageous than that. We've got to step up. We've got to solve this thing. We've got to be first.
Thank you, Congressman Perriello. Mr. Clark, your thoughts on the environment and energy.
Do we need an energy policy? Of course we need an energy policy. I think we need a common sense energy policy. Congressman Perriello was pointing out Chavez, Ahmadinejad, other South American leaders, other Middle Eastern leaders. Those leaders are from socialized countries. So what are we looking to do? We want to socialize our energy policy. We want to subsidize every innovative technology or technique. You know, if that's not the answer. Listen, the market can take care of these things. I have a vested interest in seeing renewable energies move forward. I have a project that I'm currently in the process of patenting that is an energy storage system. And I think that these things are important, but the market can drive these things. Technology can be brought about. Of course America can make jobs better than anyone else. Of course we can produce things, and we need to be in that business. But the answer isn't taking federal money and trying to decide or pick which renewable sources are going to be successful because it seems to fit our mode or the political, novelty of the time. If it's solar, if it's wind, if it's hydroelectric, whatever it may be, we have to look at common sense solutions, and we have to look at solutions that mean something. You can't point to things and say, well, you know, this country has it wrong. Look at what they're going to do. They're terrible. This is a horrible example to the United States. And then we are creeping down that path of socializing almost every single aspect of our economy and of our personal lives. And at some point, it has to stop. And just because people want to stop that doesn't mean they're opposed to a common sense energy policy. And I think to call it unpatriotic is maybe not genuine. I think there are common sense solutions, and I think it needs to be a bipartisan effort with people working across the board to come to a situation where does the free market play, where does the government work in partnership, and how, really, what can it do to stay out of the market's way in developing these new technologies? Because if it makes sense, if it's profitable, if it's going to save people money, there's no reason for corporations not to embrace this technology and move forward. I mean, and trust me, I understand how hard it is to convince people about new technologies. I understand that people need an opportunity to speak and to be heard. I don't think people want to limit that. What they're saying is we don't want the federal government, or we don't want to have to take from taxpayers to implement systems that haven't been proven, or maybe we don't see tremendous amount of viability in the near future.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. And staying with Mr. Clark, we have one question. Jeff, do you believe that President Obama is a socialist or a communist?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question. What is a socialist? I mean, are you a socialist based on where you're born? Are you a socialist because you wear a blue, and I'm not picking on you, but because you wear a blue T-shirt? What makes a person a socialist? Socialism is a political philosophy, and I think when you look at someone's actions and how they proceed, and you look at the votes they make, and you look at their philosophy in general, what they want to do with the government, the role they feel the government should play, I think that's the biggest determining factor as to whether someone has a socialistic philosophy or not. I think that in our country, our founders worked hard to establish a system of government that was dead in the middle between what they considered to be tyranny on the left, what they consider to be anarchy on the right. They worked very hard knowing that we had to put something right in the middle, and they understood that if we could stay in that balance somewhere, that things would be okay. They understood a certain number of our citizens would want to see the government do more, and a certain number would want to see the government do less. But what's happening is we're creeping down that road towards some type of European socialist democracy. And I think it's evident in the policy and the philosophical approach and belief. And I think that's the adaptation. And I think that when you look at President Obama's approach to things, he views things maybe more from that left-hand side of where our founders had originally intended us to be, where there's more government involvement, where the government plays the large role. It's not really systematic with our view of self-reliance and liberty and freedom. And is he technically a socialist? I think the only thing that you can say is you have to look at his policies, and that's a determination for each and every American to make for himself. But because he has a socialistic philosophy, it doesn't make him any less American.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. And a question for Congressman Perriello.
Sorry, go ahead.
You don't. Isn't there a disconnect between your push for austerity in government and the $30 million of earmarks you are seeking to get?
The earmark process coming in, I said I was going to fight to make it as transparent as possible. We've gone out in the community, and I've gone to every county and said, what's your top priority, and fought for it. In many cases, that's going out to Republican elected officials across the aisle, but I don't care. I don't second guess their judgment. We do our due diligence. But if they say the most important thing, that this stretch of highway is what's preventing businesses from being here, or this bridge, or this education program, I'm happy to go and fight for that, not because that person supports me, but because they say it's the best way to create jobs or improve quality of life in that area. We've put everyone, we were one of the first to put every single one of them online. We've printed them in our newsletters and papers, and we go out and fight for them. I think that this is a situation where what we tried to look for was not symbolic gestures to spread around, but what are game changers that can help create jobs in the area. It's the same thing that I've looked for in the legislation that I've supported, whether it's the Small Business Lending Fund or efforts at biofuels, or whether it's the manufacturing issues we discussed at the outset, Home Star, Rural Star, common sense solutions that make an impact in the community. So I believe we must be transparent about this. We must go after these. And we did ask for fewer than any of the other folks who were asking for them this year. And we will continue to try to look for those things that we feel like are efficient investments in the community and make the case for them. It's also important to remember that I'm one of the few up there that doesn't take any contributions from federal lobbyists. And the you can clap. And so it's not just a matter of transparency, but making sure that what I'm being responsive to is voices on the ground. My other opponent, Senator Hurd, has taken a lot of money from lobbyists and a lot of interest groups. He did when he was in the state legislature, where he requested over $150 million in earmarks, which he now says he's against. And, you know, he's continued to do so as he tries to inherit this seat in Congress. So I think what we need is people who are not out there that are just taking these contributions from lobbyists and interest groups, but are up there fighting for the people. And if it's related to jobs and a local official thinks is, or group thinks it's important, we'll do our due diligence and we'll fight for it regardless of their political stripes.
And the last question, we'll give each candidate a chance to respond. 2 minutes, and we'll start with Congressman Perriello. What is it you would like voters in the 5th District to keep in mind as they step into the voting booth on November 2nd?
Well, first of all, thank you, everyone, for being here today, and thank you for your participation. Thanks to our hosts, obviously. I think the most important thing is that this area deserves a fighter. We deserve someone who's not going to get pushed around or let other people tell them what to stand for or anything else. We need someone who understands that this is an economic crisis for the working and middle class in this country. This is not something where we just need a little nudge this way or that way or a slogan that fits on a bumper sticker. The working and middle class have been getting crushed in this country for 20 years. We need a fighter who will go up there and understand that working and middle class folks deserve economic relief and they deserve an opportunity for good paying jobs. And if we understand that the focus needs to be on small business, where 2 out of every 3 new jobs is created, if we understand that we've got to think not just about what we were good at 20 years ago, but unleashing American entrepreneurship for what we can be good at over the next 20 years, we can still beat the world. We can still make it, build it, and grow it in America better than anyone else. And I know there are a lot of people who've given up on those sectors of the American economy, but they are wrong. They are wrong to give up because we can still do it better than anyone else, and they're wrong because there is no alternative. We cannot be a nation just of computer programmers and speculators at the top and minimum wage service sector jobs at the bottom. It does not work. It cannot sustain itself. One of the great ways to turn the deficit around is to take people from unemployment benefits to being tax-paying folks with a job. That's what we need to look at, and it's not going to happen from a little nudge here or a little nudge there. With all due respect to Mr. Clark as well, the forces up in Washington are incredibly powerful, and we see them calling a lot of the shots. We need people who are willing to take that on, not just a little bit this way or vote a little bit that way, but understanding that both parties don't quite get it in terms of making, building, and growing in America again. That's what I fought for. We finally start to turn the tide, and with a little more time, I will keep fighting like a bulldog for the people of Central and Southern Virginia. Thank you.
Thank you, Congressman Perriello. And now, Jeff Clark. Jeff, what do you want folks to keep in mind in the 5th District when they vote on November 2nd?
Well, I think we need to really consider doing something different in our country, moving our country in a new direction. Congressman Perriello speaks of special interest groups like somehow they're isolated things out there. Make no mistake about it, ladies and gentlemen, the two largest special interest groups in the United States are the Republican and Democratic Party. They are what foster, they are what enable, and they are what encourage the special interest groups and this meddling in our political system. Until something is done to break the duopoly in Washington, we are going to continue to see corruption. no matter what the intention of the individual politicians are. Congressman Perriello is right. These forces are strong. These forces are inset inside Washington. But all too often, and I know this happens on the Republican Party, our politicians are asked to sign oaths of loyalty to the party. How can you sign an oath of loyalty to the party and stand there and look your constituents in the face and say that you're going to represent their interest first? We have done this time and time again. We have gone into that voting booth and we have pulled the lever for Republicans and we have pulled the lever for Democrats. And we still see our country in a mess. I don't think many of us can say that, hey, we think our country is in better position than it was 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 30 years ago. The truth of the matter is, until we do something different, until we demand something different, we're going to continue to get the same thing. Many people believe that maybe an independent can't make a difference in Washington, but I disagree. I believe that by sending an independent, you can send a powerful message to Washington, a message to both parties that says this: okay, we're going to give you other opportunities. We're going to allow you to get your house in order. We're going to allow you to start assuming responsibility and assuming integrity on the behalf of the American people. But you see that guy over there, or those few people over there, or that young woman over there? They represent the direction our country can go in. And if you continue to promote irresponsibility, if you continue to engage in corrupt behavior, we will not hesitate for a moment to turn away from both of these political parties and take back our country. Our country was never designed to be governed and manipulated and coerced by two parties alone. George Washington, in his farewell address, warned us of that. And we are seeing the result of that. When you have a two-party system, we engage in fear-based politics all the time. What happens after 2 years of Congressman Perriello? The Republican Party is trying to keep its focus on a single individual. They are not seeing the forest for the tree. What they're trying to do is they're trying to keep our minds off the overall problem in Washington, and that is corruption. And that is the stranglehold that the duopoly that is the two-party system has on Americans right now.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. We will end by thanking Peter Thompson and all the folks here at the Senior Center who work very hard to create a real Charlottesville treasure. We thank the Senior Statesman of Virginia. And I just want to say, before you leave, I want to thank everyone who was here today for coming out to learn and to ask questions and to participate in our community and in this great democratic enterprise that helps to protect the freedoms we and our children enjoy. My favorite Jefferson quote is this: come forward then and give us the aid of your talents and the weight of your character towards the new establishment of democracy. And I am so proud to be in a room and to live in a country and in a state where people get that and they come forward as an American, as a Virginian, and especially as the daddy of 2 8-year-olds. I want to thank you all for being here today and for setting an example of citizenship. Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, I appreciate that. I wasn't trying to call you a truth.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.